In this hour, again, our guests, Philip Graham and Tanya Leotsakos. Philip teaches at the U of I and is a writer. Tanya works at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And every once in a while here on the program, they come with new books to recommend. So that's what we're up to. And I think it's Philip's turn.
Okay. This is a book that I've really come to love. It's called The Conversations, Walter Mersch and the Art of Editing Film. And Michael Ondaatje, the author of The English Patient, is listed as the author. But in fact, it is indeed an equal conversation, actually an unequal conversation between Michael Ondaatje and Walter Mersch, because Walter Mersch does most of the talking. Walter Mersch is the person who did the editing for the film version of Ondaatje's novel, The English Patient, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture when it came out, and Mersch won the Academy Award for Best Editing. Walter Mersch has done the editing for all three Godfather movies and for... let's see, what else has he done? He's done The Talented Mr. Ripley and American Graffiti and The Conversation and what's the one about Vietnam?
Apocalypse Now.
Right, yeah, wow. Why did I forget that? So he's a great, great, great film editor. And he's incredibly eloquent about the making of films. And here is a section called Negative 20 Questions, in which he compares making films to a parlor game based on quantum physics. So Mersch says, there's a great game. I forget whether we've talked about it. Negative 20 questions? Ondaatje, no, we haven't talked about it. Mersch then says, it was invented by John Wheeler, a quantum physicist who was a young graduate student of Niels Bohr's in the 1930s. Wheeler is the man who invented the term black hole. He's an extremely articulate proponent of the best of 20th century physics, still alive, I believe, still teaching, writing. Anyway, he thought up a parlor game that reflects the way the world is constructed at the quantum level. It involves, say, four people, Michael, Anthony, Walter, and Aggie. From the point of view of one of those people, Michael, the game that's being played is the normal 20 questions. Ordinary 20 questions, I guess you'd call it. So Michael leaves the room under the illusion that the other three players are going to look around and collectively decide on the chosen object to be guessed by him, say, the alarm clock. Michael expects that when they've made their decision, they will ask him to come back in and try to guess the object in fewer than 20 questions. Under normal circumstances, the game is a mixture of perspicacity and luck. No, it's not bigger than a bread box. No, you can't eat it. Those kinds of things. But in Wheeler's version of the game, when Michael leaves the room, the three remaining players don't communicate with one another at all. Instead, each of them silently decides on an object. Then they call Michael back in. So there's a disparity between what Michael believes and what the underlying truth is. Nobody knows what anyone else is thinking. The game proceeds regardless, which is where the fun comes in. Michael asks Walter, is the object bigger than a bread box? Walter, who has picked the alarm clock, says, no. Now Anthony, who has chosen the sofa, which is bigger than a bread box, has chosen the sofa, which is bigger than a bread box, and since Michael is going to ask him the next question, Anthony must quickly look around the room and come up with something else. A coffee cup, which is smaller than a bread box. So when Michael asks Anthony, if I emptied out my pockets, could I put their contents in this object? Anthony says, yes. Now, Aggie's choice may have been the small pumpkin carved from Halloween, which would also contain Michael's keys and coins. So when Michael asks, is it edible? Aggie says, yes. That's a problem. That's a problem for Walter and Anthony, who have chosen inedible objects. They now have to change their selection to something edible, hollow, and smaller than a bread box. So, a complex vortex of decision-making is set up, a logical but unpredictable change of ifs and thens. To end successfully, the game must produce, in fewer than 20 questions, an object that satisfies all the logical requirements, smaller than a bread box, edible, hollow, etc. Two things can happen. Success. This vortex can give birth to an answer that will seem to be inevitable in retrospect. Of course, it's the whatever. And the game ends with Michael still believing that he has just played ordinary 20 questions. In fact, no one chose the whatever to start with. And Anthony, Walter, and Aggie have been sweating it out, doing these hidden mental gymnastics always one step ahead of failure, which is the other possible result, failure. The game can break down catastrophically. By question 15, let's say, the questions asked have generated logical requirements so complex that nothing in the room can satisfy them. And when Michael asks Anthony the 16th question, Anthony breaks down and has to confess that he doesn't know. And Michael is finally let in on the secret. The game was negative 20 questions all along. Wheeler suggests that the nature of perception and reality at the quantum level, and perhaps above, is somehow similar to this game. When I read about this, it reminded me acutely of filmmaking. There is an agreed-upon game, which is the screenplay, but in the process of making the film, there are so many variables that everyone has a slightly different interpretation of the screenplay. The cameraman develops an opinion, then is told that Clark Gable has been cast in that part. He thinks, Gable? I didn't think it would be Gable. If it's Gable, I'm going to have to replan. Then the art director does something to the set, and the actor says, this is my apartment? All right, if this is my apartment, then I'm a slightly different person from who I thought I was. I will change my performance. The camera operator following him thinks, why is he doing that? Oh, it's because, all right, I'll have to widen out because he's doing these unpredictable things. And then the editor does something unexpected with those images, and this gives the director an idea about the script, so he changes a line. And so the costumer sees that and decides the actor can't wear dungarees. And so it goes, with everyone continuously modifying their preconceptions. A film can succeed in the end, spiraling in on itself to a final result that looks as if it had been predicted long in advance in every detail, but in fact, it grew out of a mad scramble, as everyone involved took advantage of all the various decisions everyone else had been making. On the other hand, a film can break down too. Some inconsistency, emotional or logical, can pose a question that nothing in the room, that is, say, the film, can answer. The most obvious of these failures is the miscasting of a lead character. His presence in the film poses a question that's inconsistent with everything else. But films can ultimately fail for much more subtle reasons, death by a thousand cuts, the interference of the studio, bad weather, what the grip had for breakfast that crucial morning, the fact that the producer was going through a divorce, etc. All these things are in complex ways encoded into the body of the film, sometimes for good, and the film is enriched by the process, sometimes not. Then it's aborted, abandoned during production, or stillborn, finished but never released, or released, fatally handicapped, to dismal reviews and no business. This comparison of filmmaking and Wheeler's game goes some distance, I think, to answering the perennial question, what were they thinking when they made that film? How could anyone ever think that could work?
That's great.
Very interesting.
That is great.
Very interesting.
So this book is The Conversations.
The Conversations,
Walter Murch and the Art of
Editing Film, with Michael Ondaatje listed as the author. And it goes on for 300 pages, lots of pictures, great book to read about film. And you don't even have to know the movies in order to appreciate the mind of Walter Murch and Michael Ondaatje's reaction to it. It's also a book about writing as well, because Ondaatje brings a lot of his understanding of what it's like to write a novel to what he hears about Murch, and he's saying what it's like to edit and direct a film.
Yeah, I think that's one of the role of the editor is one of the great often unacknowledged things that people don't understand about. You figure, well, okay, the actors are important because they're in front of the camera, and the director is important because the director is the person who says, okay, we'll do this and we'll do this and we'll do this. Yeah. But after all that gets done and everything's on the film, then there's someone who decides how all that gets put together.
Right.
And that can make a huge difference. You can either make it so you have a film that's unintelligible,
yeah. mm-hmm.
or a film that's clear, a film that's slow, or a film that's exciting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of that is about editing.
Because
sure.
basically 90% of the film doesn't make it into the finished product. They cut on they use a huge amount of film in order to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And if I might make a connection between those 9 people out of 10 who aren't contributing, if you want to get in the movie, folks, if you don't want to be on the cutting room floor, you should send in money here to WILL.
Is this guy a writer or what?
Yes.
Can that guy sling a metaphor or
yeah.
what?
Okay. Come on, the movie marquee is waiting for you out there.
All right. That's Philip Graham, ladies and gentlemen. Also with us here is Tanya Latsakis from Pages for All Ages Bookstore, and this is one of those shows occasionally we do with them where they talk about new books. So we've got that. We've got the list. We can make the list available to you, and if there was someone listening, there's a book you'd like to recommend, you can do that too. Okay. Next up is Tanya.
Okay, this is a book that I never would have picked up in a million years. It's because of the dust jacket. It looks bad. Does it not look bad? Does it not look like something that...
It looks like homework.
Yeah, it just doesn't... Yeah. But I had... it was recommended to me by someone who... We always love the same books, always. So, of course, I had to read it. It's called We Need to Talk About Kevin. by Lionel Shriver. She is a writer. I believe she lives in England, and she does pretty well there, but not so much here. So this is a book about so many things. I'm not giving anything away by saying this either, because you find out right away from the very beginning. This is a book about a woman whose son pulled a Columbine and killed a lot of students. And it's about her. It's written in a series of letters from her to her husband, Franklin, Kevin's father. And they're obviously not together anymore. It ruined their marriage. It, you know, terrible things happen and the world falls apart. But she never wanted to have a child, really. And this is the interesting question that the book raises, which is what grabbed me right away. She never really wanted to have children. She always kind of thought she would, because all women sort of do. But she never really felt these yearnings that all of her friends felt. But her husband, of course, wanted a child, and you're married, and, well, that's what you do. So she had a child. She had Kevin. And the question that this book raises the most, I think, is how do we become who we are? Because her behavior towards her son, that she never really wanted, is at sometimes pretty despicable. But other times, you get the sense that, it's not even a sense, you can obviously see that Kevin was born different. He was born angry. Mm. He was born troubled and very different. And she, you wonder if that comes from the womb. Could he sense all the time from the womb that he wasn't wanted? Mm. Or was it just something within him? Who knows? I'll read a quick passage. This is after Kevin has been born. He's several months old, and this is what this woman is dealing with from day one of life with Kevin. I know you doubt me on this. This is a letter, obviously, to her husband. I know you doubt me on this, but I did try very hard to form a passionate attachment to my son. But I had never experienced my feelings for you, for example, as an exercise that I was obliged to rehearse like scales on the piano. The harder I tried, the more aware I became that my very effort was an abomination. Surely all this tenderness that in the end I simply aped should have come knocking at the door uninvited. Hence it was not just Kevin who depressed me, or the fact that your own affections were increasingly diverted. I depressed me. I was guilty of emotional malfeasance. But Kevin depressed me as well, and I do mean Kevin, and not the baby. From the very beginning, that child was particular to me. Whereas you often asked, how's the kid, or how's my boy, or where's the baby? To me, he was never the baby. He was a singular, unusually cunning individual who had arrived to stay with us and just happened to be very small. For you, he was our son, or once you started to give up on me, my son. There was a persistently generic character to your adoration that I'm certain he sensed. Before you get your back up, I don't mean that as a criticism. It must be this overarching commitment to what is really an abstraction, to one's children, right or wrong, that can be even more fierce than the commitment to them as explicit, difficult people, and that can consequently keep you devoted to them, when as individuals, they disappoint. On my part, it was this broad covenant with children in theory that I may have failed to make, and to which I was unable to resort when Kevin finally tested my maternal ties to a perfect mathematical limit on Thursday. She refers to Thursday, the day that the Columbine thing happened. Yeah. I didn't vote for parties, but for candidates. My opinions were as... Sorry, missed it. I had no problem with abortion, but abhorred capital punishment, which I suppose meant that I embraced the sanctity of life only in grown-ups. My environmental habits were capricious. I'd placed a brick in our toilet tank, but after submitting to dozens of spit-in-the-air showers with derisory European water pressure, I would bask under a deluge of scalding water for half an hour. By the same token, I could not love a child. I would have to love this one. I was connected to the world by a multitude of threads, you by a few sturdy guide ropes. It was the same with patriotism. You loved the idea of the United States so much more powerfully than the country itself. And it was thanks to your embrace of the American aspiration that you could overlook the fact that your fellow Yankee parents were lining up overnight outside FAO Schwartz with thermoses of chowder to buy a limited release of Nintendo. In the particular dwells the tawdry. In the conceptual dwells the grand, the transcendent, the everlasting. Earthly countries and single malignant little boys can go to hell. The idea of countries and the idea of sons triumph for eternity. Although neither of us ever went to church, I came to conclude that you were a naturally religious person. Kevin is a nightmare. He's basically the worst child you could ever hope to have or fear to have. He screams constantly. He hates everything. He has no joy. He's absolutely a joyless child. The family's well off. The parents seem to be happy together. There's no explanation for why he's so miserable, but he goes on like that his entire life. And there are a couple of things withheld from the reader until the very end of this book that came as a tremendous shock. I never could have dreamed, because you know all along that he killed people. You know all along he pulled the Columbine. But the way in which he does it comes as a tremendous surprise. The other thing that comes as a...
Philip's getting nervous.
I won't do it.
Okay, good, good, good.
I won't do it. I won't say it. You just have to read it.
See, I have to say, Tanya, we go through this every time. Tanya comes in here, and she's very excited,
it's true.
The book, and she wants to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And Philip, you can see,
he gets more and more nervous.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's afraid...
He doesn't like to give away the ending.
Yeah, he's afraid she's going to give away something really important.
Writer, I'm a writer.
And, you know, so so it gets to the point where I feel like I have to intervene.
Right. Anyway, marvelously written. A couple of big shockers at the end. Almost reads like a mystery in some places. Hmm. And speaks to the question of nature or nurture. Speaks to the question of women who think they might not want children probably shouldn't have them.
All right. The book is We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver. And Lionel is a woman.
A woman,
right.
Yes.
All right. We have a caller here, and if the caller wouldn't mind just being real patient with us for a minute or two, we also would like to, once again, we want to give. That's what we're about in this program, is giving. We give and we give and we give.
Amen, brother.
And what we're now asking for people this morning is that they will give back just a little bit in the form of a financial contribution. We really rely on your contributions. Now, I'm sure everyone understands that we do get some money from the federal government and money from the state government, and have for a long time now. But that base of funding has continued to shrink for a variety of reasons. So we're starting to think about, well, we really need to move the funding of public broadcasting in a different direction so that we're not relying on that tax-based support like we used to. What we have to do is rely on the support of people who listen, and probably that's the way that it should be. Yeah? So if you have listened, but you have never supported the station, this would be a great time for you to join this group we call the Friends of WILL. These are the people that support us with their dollars. You can call us right now, in fact, at 244-9455. It will take probably about 2 minutes, not long at all. And as a way of saying thanks, we've got books that we want to find homes for.
Absolutely. Homes for books. That's what we're about right during this this time on Focus 580. We're talking about books. We have all these books. The publishers send us all these hardcover books. They're new, high quality. A lot of them, actually, some of them have been subjects of interviews on the show. Mm-hmm. We can't name all the titles because there are too damn many of them. But you can get in on this if you make a pledge call at the $40 annual level. That makes you a member of the Friends of WILL. We'll send you either a fiction or a nonfiction book. You choose the category. Make sure to tell the phone volunteer which you would like. Again, the number 217, the area code 244 9455. Maeve Riley, our Patterns editor, Patterns Magazine, which you get at the basic membership level of $40, is in our pledge center. And how are we doing so far, Maeve? We're looking for 40 pledges before noon.
That's right. And I think we're at about 12. So we've got a ways to go. But, you know, it's great that we've heard from so many people so far. We've heard from people in Paris, Aurora, St. Joe, and Claypool, Indiana. So thank you, people, for calling. And if you haven't made a call, now's the time to do so. You know, Jack, I was thinking for $40, that's less than a dollar a week, you could get your basic membership as a friend of WILL, which entitles you to get Patterns on a monthly basis, and you can get a free book, either fiction or nonfiction, as our way of saying thank you. You can, sorry, Tanya, but you can barely buy a book for $40 anymore, even a nice hardcover book.
It's true.
So go to the phone, call 217-244-9455.
Now, we've heard from a lot of different towns, mostly from Champaign-Urbana, but we haven't heard from, let's see, where haven't we heard from?
We haven't heard from Savoy, and we haven't heard from Bloomington or Normal. Or Sydney, and...
How about Foosland? Have you heard from there?
No, we haven't heard from
I just love the
Foosland.
Name of that town. Anybody in Foosland?
Foosland.
I'll chip in $10 myself if you call.
It's like a magical place.
Don't you make fun of Foosland.
It does.
Don't you make fun of Foosland.
Isn't that where foosball was invented?
We're not making fun. It's interesting.
That's Foosland, Germany, I think it was.
Sorry.
217-244-9455. And remember, folks, we really depend on you to keep this thing going here. There are not too many places that have a two-hour-long conversation on books where you get, you know, people who are fanatics talking about great... hope you don't mind me calling you that.
Fanatics?
All right, aficionado. How about that?
That's
okay.
Much nicer.
Yes, fanatic is the dark side of aficionado, yeah.
There are not too many places that have this kind of conversation, and that actually, you know, all year long we have all these author interviews of all these great books. We've had National Book Award winners, we've had Nobel Prize winners, we've had, you know, all these people who write great books who never won anything but just wrote a great book, and you get to hear them talk about it, and you get to talk with them directly, and this is the kind of thing that we think is really important to the, you know, the breadth and depth of ideas and understanding and perspective. I mean, that's what this show is really all about. I'm kind of tearing up over this here. If this is the kind of thing that you support, then we need to hear from you. Become a friend of WILL with your $40 basic membership level pledge, and we'll send you a book along with all the other great things you get with your pledge.
Yeah. We bring you the books that aren't the prize winners. Most books don't win prizes,
that's
but they're
right.
still wonderful.
That's
you know?
Right.
It's like that 9 out of 10 people who don't contribute. Again, we bring you the unseen, unheralded books. Now, if you want to be a prize winner, contribute.
For all of those great authors who have never won the Booker Prize
right, exactly.
or the National Book Award.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Jack, I think Philip's after your job.
Hey, you can have it. No. Actually, my job has changed quite a bit here. You know, I started out as assistant producer, then I became associate producer, then I became just producer, and then now I'm producer emeritus. Now, I think, you know, this is a way of not giving me a raise. They just changed my title.
We were hoping you wouldn't catch on.
You finally got it.
There's a pattern. 217-244-9455. Your pledge won't go to a raise for me, but it will support the station. Give us a call, please.
All right. Well, we'll get back to our book talk here. And one more time at the end, we could yammer some more about financial contributions. Our guests, Philip Graham, Tanya Leotsakos. Philip is a writer. He also teaches writing here at the U of I. And Tanya works out at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. And between the two of them, they are always looking for, they're always reading and they're always looking for new things. And every once in a while here on the program, they come and they bring new books, things that they have come across recently that they enjoyed and that they think that some of the folks who are listening would enjoy too. We do also have a couple of callers.
Okay,
well, we have one that we'll talk to, and so let's do that. In Aurora, once again, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, I thought of a new book I had read a couple of months ago, The 55 Essentials of Teaching.
Ah, yes.
By Ron Clark. I think it's number 6 on the New York Times best reading list.
It's on there.
Hmm. Yeah, I knew it was. It speaks to the same situation, the essentials of teaching.
Great.
But this author is different. He gives answers, 55 answers. He was a teacher of the year in 2001, and it, like I said, it's different than Pat Conroy's book, The Water is Wide. He just told how he had to do it in the on the island where he taught. But Ron Clark was also on an island, Manhattan Island, and he taught in Harlem. And he came up from one of the Carolinas when he heard that they needed teachers, and he went there and taught. And it's a wonderful book, and I hope it goes all the way to the top of the list, because in these days where teaching is a very difficult thing, because the teacher nowadays has to teach discipline before they can start to teach teaching. And it's a very difficult teaching situation, and I wish a teacher would call in and tell us the problems they're having. Maybe that would be a good thing to have a program about, have a teachers come in and talk to that issue, because there are being, you know, it is being talked about much these days. Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
That caller might enjoy a book, well, actually any of Esme Codell's books. The most famous one is called Educating Esme. She's an educator in inner city, and she actually came for a signing at our store recently, and she was a very powerful speaker. She has a lot of insight.
Yeah, Celeste has talked with her a couple times on the Afternoon Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I think next turn here on the panel is Philip.
Uh-huh. Yep. This actually is an award-winning book. It was a winner of the Flannery O'Connor Award, which is a very prestigious short story award. It's a story collection called Break Any Woman Down by Dana Johnson. And though it was published by a university press originally, the paperback was taken by Anchor Books. So it's now in a very available paperback form. Dana Johnson is a young writer who manages to do so many different voices that it, you wonder how she manages to channel them all. She has Iranian immigrants who speak, two sisters, one of whom speaks English very well and one who doesn't, you know. African-Americans of all types. She's an African-American writer. She also gets this Kentucky white boy that I'm about to read wonderfully. And this first story, which I absolutely love, Melvin in the Sixth Grade, is about a young woman a young girl whose parents move out of the projects. They move to a white neighborhood, and she's trying desperately to fit in, and she's not having much success, and she becomes friends with somebody who comes in from the outside after her, a guy named Melvin, who's from Kentucky, a real kind of white trash, kind of white cracker kind of person, you know. I mean, that's what everybody thinks of him, you know, but Melvin doesn't take any garbage, you know, and the narrator really wishes she could be like him, and she just is so in love with him. And so here they are walking back home after school, and she's just hanging around with him. "Hey, Melvin," I started, trying to kill time and keep him with me a little longer. "You going to Lisa White's Disneyland party?" But the seconds the words were out of my mouth, I knew it was the dumbest question I could have asked. Like Lisa would have asked Melvin to her party, like Lisa even thought about Melvin. That was just stupid to even think about. "How dumb are you?" I asked myself. Melvin took a cigarette out of his mouth and offered me a puff. He knew he wouldn't. He knew I wouldn't. We had that little joke going on between us. He got a kick out of me being a goody-two-shoes and not taking a puff, even though I nearly died at the thought of my lips touching something that Melvin's lips had touched. He grinned. "There's your brother," he said, trying to scare me about the cigarette, but I knew Owen was already at work. "You ain't funny, Melvin Bukeford," I said, and punched him in the shoulder. He rubbed it like it hurt. I guess I punched him harder than I thought. "Dang, killer, you tough when you want to be, ain't you?" He took another puff before he said, "Lisa asked me to go to her party, but I said I didn't believe I could cause of the money, but shoot, I can steal me enough money to go to Disneyland. I just ain't too impressed with her and no Disneyland neither." I could not believe what I was hearing. Lisa asked Melvin and he said no? I thought I was asked because I was liked, or on my way to being liked. Melvin said, "She's just asking everybody to say what everybody came to her little party. So what about her little pissy party?" He stubbed out a cigarette. "Later, Miss Avery," he said, pulling on his jacket. "And don't be reaching into my stash of cigs, else a big rat'll chew off your fingers." "Nuh-uh, Melvin," I sang. I still stung from Lisa not really warming up to me that much after all, but Melvin's teasing and winking and dimples and smoke drifting hazy over his watery blue eyes made me happier. I would never need anything else in a man as long as I walk the planet Earth. I watched him walk downhill in that odd, slopey way he did, knees bending a little too deep at every step, like a flamingo. A flamingo smoking a cigarette, wearing a studded denim jacket.
Wow, I have to read it.
Terrific book. Terrific book. And all the stories have so many different kinds of people in them, and she gets every voice spot on.
Mm, all right. That is Breaking a Woman Down.
That's my kind of voice.
a collection of stories by Dana Johnson. All right. Very good. Well, we could go on here. We don't have any callers right at the moment, so we'll go back over to Tanya.
I want to mention I hesitate to call it a children's book.
Maurice Sendak?
Yeah. A lot of controversy going on about this among staff members. This is a book. Oh, it's called Brundabar by Maurice Sendak, illustrated by Tony Kushner. Illustrated by Maurice Sendak. Tony Kushner has translated. It's from an opera during World War II, which a lot... Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't, but I can imagine what's coming.
You know what's coming. A lot of children in a particular concentration camp... which one? Terezin. Yeah. They used to perform this for one another. So the issue with this book is that we have it in the children's department. It has Maurice Sendak's name on it, you know?
But the subject's
not for children. Illustrated picture book, but the subject really is not for children. I would say that this is more a history book than anything else. I think it should be in Holocaust studies for adults to look at. And to that's not to say that children can't appreciate it, but I don't think this is a good way to introduce them to the Holocaust. Yeah. But it is very insightful for adults and older children to look at. The illustrations are really nice, Maurice Sendak illustrations. And they're sort of bright and happy in the forefront, and in the background, they're very dark. You see a lot of swastikas. It's clearly Germany.
Yeah.
Brundabar is... this character who he just represents evil in the book. It's sort of abstract. It's an opera, so it's funny that they've put it in picture book form, but it's pretty interesting. And they have to go, the children have to go to town and buy milk for their sick, dying mother, but they don't have any money for the milk. So they're going to sing for the milk. They're going to sing, and they get their whole, the idea is they get every Jewish child. They all get together, and they're all going to sing because one voice isn't loud enough for anyone to pay attention to. So they're all going to get together and sing for the money for the milk. And eventually they do scare away Brundabar. At the end, however, there is a letter from Brundabar that he has sent to this concentration camp. And it says, "They believe they've won the fight. They believe I'm gone. Not quite. Nothing ever works out neatly. Bullies don't give up completely. One departs, the next appears, and we shall meet again, my dears. Though I go, I won't go far. I'll be back. Love, Brundabar." So,
parents, your children will wake up in the middle of the night screaming.
Yeah, you don't want to read this to a young child just because it's cute on the front and says Maurice Sendak.
this is more a warning than a recommendation, right?
It's a warning, but it is a recommendation to adults and to older children. And if you have a child who's reading about the Holocaust, learning about the Holocaust, I know there's one customer that comes in a lot, and her daughter is very interested, and she's in about fourth grade. I recommended this to them because she already knows, you know, and so this is just a different perspective on it. But it's chilling. It's chilling. And I'm glad that he has given it some attention, this opera, because I knew nothing about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a novel by a writer named Stuart David, and the novel is called Nalda Said. Now, the novelist is also the bass player for the British band Belle and Sebastian, and I probably wouldn't have picked up this novel because I figured, well, what does this guy think he's doing, blah, blah, blah. But one of the most mysterious things ever happened to me was I got a letter in the mail sent to me at the university, and all it had was a catalog from the book publisher, which is, I think, Turtle Point Press, and someone had circled this book, and there was no comment, no return address or name. I had no idea who sent this to me. So I got a little intrigued. So I found it at Tanya's bookstore, and it's a terrific book. And it's about a young man who has been basically living all his life after his parents died with a woman who was somehow related to him called Nalda. And she's told him these stories, which he has come to believe, and he shouldn't have. he's a little too credulous. And so he's got this strange voice where you can tell he doesn't talk to people very much because it's an odd, peculiar voice with its rhythms, as you'll hear. And he's talking to the reader, actually. Have I told you any proper things yet about the lady who used to live in our town who didn't like winters? I've been just about to say it a few times, but I don't think I did quite do any, so instead I'll say some here about her now. He and Nalda, by the way, worked as gardeners. She lived on the far away and other side of the town from Nalda and me, the winter lady. And always, when spring had already been making the flowers come back alive again for a few weeks, Nalda would say one day, "I think the winter lady must be back by now." And so, as soon as what job we were doing got to be finished up with, the very first place we tried next would be the winter lady's. Her house was huge, made up of these very light brown stones with lots of ivies and vines clinging to them, and her garden was huge, too. Anyway, although, hers would always be the first place we tried for new work after the flowers had started, and most times she would be already waiting for us, and there would always be lots of work to be started and done, even just in cutting things back and chopping down the grass, and even cleaning up last year's leaves because of how the winter lady had been gone since before it was even the end of summer. The thing was, you see, the winter lady only stayed in our own town from after spring had started until just before the end of summer each year. And in fact, that was the only part of time she ever stayed anywhere, because what she did, Nalda said, was to follow the living seasons around the globe. Summer is always somewhere, Nalda told me. It's like the moon. And she explained, like when it's winter on one side of the world and summer is on the very opposite one. And the same with autumns and springs, too, which makes the summer and winter move around a little bit. So the winter lady, she just followed the seasons around which she wanted, and Nalda said she had houses in all places and all just as big as the one in our own town. What I always did, whenever she came to talk to Nalda while we were working there, I used to spy on her very secretively when she wasn't looking any. And I was always amazed about how much younger than Nalda she looked to be, even though she was so very much older. And it always amazed me, too, to know that one day I would look older than the winter lady. Because the thing was, you see, the winter lady was more than 300 years old. Only, on the outside, she had stayed by being the age she was when she last lived through a winter. And Nalda said that was how it happened. If you didn't pass through all the seasons each year, and didn't share in all the dying and rebirth of all the plants and leaves, you would never grow on any. But too, she said, if ever the winter lady was to live through a winter somewhere, now she would age all those years she'd missed at once, and her body would suddenly become all the age which she really was. Mm. Now, Nalda has also told this poor young man a story about his origins and that his father was a jewel thief and that there's a jewel inside him that his father hid inside him that is one of the most valuable jewels in the world, and they're people looking for it all over the world, and he actually never makes friends, and he runs from town to town thinking that people are after his jewel inside him, and he has all these elaborate rituals, and it's a terribly, terribly sad story, but also kind of oddly beautiful about a man who has this made-up story that he actually believes that prevents him from having relationships with other people, and he comes to this point where he actually has a chance to break through the story that Nalda has told him, and that's the basic drama of the novel. It's a beautiful little book.
Great. All right. We have about 5 minutes left, maybe, and we have a couple of callers, so we'll bring them in. Gibson City. We have someone in Gibson City on line one.
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes. Well, I am talking about children's books that I fell in love with reading to my children back in the 80s. Mm. And what is a Peter Benchley book called The Girl from the Sea of Cortez? In fact, my youngest daughter and I, my husband, I don't know where he was, he was out of town, but we ended up crawling to bed together, and I think I read it to her. And I think she could read, but we were so enthralled with the book that I think we read till like 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's, I don't know if you are familiar with that book or not, but, you know, Peter Benchley, you think of Jaws.
Yeah.
But
it's a familiar name, yeah, the title.
The Girl from the Sea of Cortez.
Mm-hmm.
That's by Peter Benchley.
Oh, great. Well, thanks for the series. I know that Philip is a great proponent of
reading it.
To children and with with children.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, right now, the American Girl series, they make these books about, you know, all their little dolls, but they have a new series about international girls, and they're set like in the 1850s in Ethiopia or in the early 19th century in China, and they're wonderful, empowering books about girls who face adversity with a great deal of bravery, and I'm reading those to my daughter right now, who's 8, and they're wonderful.
I wish I had grandchildren to read to.
Uh-huh.
And the other book is The Endless Step by Esther, and I forget what her last name is, but it's about a gal in Poland that her and her family end up being transported to Siberia. And it's based on a true story. She's a person, and she eventually moved to the United States. But that was another book that I read with my children, and I just, for me as an adult, I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's about how they, you know, it's in Siberia, very cold, and it's very hard to eke out a living, but how her parents taught her that decency, treating everybody decently, and well, and then the whole thing, you know, by a child's eyes of what happened, you know, to her, and how eventually she got to, you know, come to the United States. But those are the two books I want to mention, and thank you for letting me do that.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
We'll do one more, and the caller here is on line number 2, and in Weldon. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to let everybody know about a book I'm about halfway through right now. The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. Anyone out there that sensing a lack of purpose in their life, I recommend this book highly. Hmm. Give your life a little wheel alignment, so to speak. Not to step on Rick Karch's toes there, sorry. So I just wanted to throw that one out.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
And to go back here to the other book that the first of these callers suggested, it is indeed, the title of the book is The Endless Step. That's STEPPE, by Esther Hautzig. And it was came out in paperback in 1989, and as far as we know, should be still in print. It's listed on the website of that online bookseller that will remain nameless on this program.
Yeah. Can I finish with a poem?
Yes,
okay.
please
finish with a poem. Yes. Okay, this is a poem by one of my favorite poets, David Joss. I've recommended this book before. It's called Improvising Rivers. This is the last poem in the book. It's called Stardust. Stardust. Tonight, the wind winds down the hill to the house we refuse for a moment to enter. So what if we're cold, our skin stippled with goosebumps, and the firewood is waiting for the match? We linger a moment longer, looking up at what reminds us we are not the first to stand here pausing before this house, nor the last. Time is as vast as this sky, and as dark. Yet we are made of stardust, the calcium in our bones and iron in our blood, the fallout of the first supernovas, and the wind, that original music, still strums the leaves in our yard and the woods beyond. Its melody will last almost forever, yet we listen as if we will never hear it again. In a minute, we'll go inside and light the fire, then hold each other as others after us will hold each other, and watch the temporary take flight. The sunlight that wound the logs, escaping at last, sparks rising from the flames, like stars returning home.
Beautiful.
That's very nice. That's a nice way to finish.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you guys both very much. We always look forward to having you here and hearing about what you've been reading and get some recommendations.